Chapter 30. They went out the front door, up the stairs to street level, up the stairs to Feldstein's entry, and into the building. Access to the second and third floors was both by stair and elevator. The elevator opened on the third floor vestibule, single window looking out on Worth Street, apartments to either side. Neath apartment looked lived in. There were no homey touches, no welcoming mat or door sign. The apartment with the open window facing Bachman's belonged to Bloomberg. Sarah knocked. Nada. Cop kind knocked on Anderson's door. No answer there. Well. Curiouser and curiouser. Do me a favor. Keep an eye out while I fiddle with this lock. Hey, officer, I don't mean to tell you your business, but isn't that illegal? She turned her peepers on him. Let's just call it extra legal, okay? Cop kind shrugged, grinned. Not like I'm a perfect citizen. Bloomberg's apartment was sealed with a master lock deadbolt, very difficult to pick. Shielding the witchblade from Copkind with her body, Sarah confronted the lock and channeled her concentration through her wrist. The witchblade morphed and crawled over her index finger and into the lock like a thing alive. An instant later the tumblers gave. Sarah turned the knob and the door swung inward. Bingo, she whispered. Copkind gaped. How did you do that? Sorry. Secret cop trick. Silently, she stepped into the apartment, holding up a hand to keep Copkind back. She listened. She smelled. She tasted the air. The apartment was empty. Not only was it empty, it was unfurnished, save for the living room facing Bachman's. Set 3 feet inside the window mounted on a black tripod was a tube-like device that resembled a telescope, with a parabolic boom mounted directly below, also facing out. What's that? Copkind whispered, having caught the caution bug. It's a laser listening device. She looked at it closely without touching. It was plugged into a wall outlet. There was some kind of black transfer box with a cord going to the phone jack. Sarah bet that when she checked the lease, Bloomberg would turn out to be a front for Chalmers himself. As Copkind said, curiouser and curiouser. One victim of the samurai killer had been spying on another. Over a sword, she bet. She took David's hand. Come on. Let's get out of here. They returned to David's living room where he poured them each another glass. What does it mean? I don't know. But I intend to find out. You said you had something to tell me. Do I ever? I don't know how much stock you place in ghost stories, but you know that book Hecht showed you? Kuyami Gusa? Well, I have an English translation. Without taking her eyes off him, Sarah sipped her wine. You do? Hecht told me he was paying someone boku bucks to translate. How did you come by a copy? I bought it at a yard sale in California several years ago. He got up, stood on the stool and reached for his copy. A cloud of dust rose when he set it on the coffee table. Holy smokes. What does that thing weigh? About 20 pounds. Anyhow, you told me you believed these killings are about Muramasa's swords. Yeah. The killer's after sword or swords. Well, I've read the whole thing, believe it or not, and that struck a chord, so I began reading, and sure enough, I uncovered this character who collected Muramasa's. Let me just read it to you. This incident concerns the Lord of Funai, Bungo Province, Takenaka Hunemen no Sho, Shigeyoshi, as well as his son, Kenzaburo. At the time of the incident, 1632, Shigeyoshi had taken up the important position of Nagasaki magistrate. While in office, there were some other irregularities and the shogunate in Edo initiated legal proceedings. Shigeyoshi was convicted of his crimes, and, as a consequence of his punishment, his property was confiscated. As it happened, there were some Muramasa blades among his possessions. In fact, the number was said to have totaled 24 blades. Because of that crime, he was sentenced to be banished to a distant island. However, the sentence was increased in severity, and together with his son their seppuku was to be presided over by the Grand Superintendent Mizuno Kawachi no Kami Morinobu. Just the fact that Shigeyoshi possessed a large number of Muramasa blades indicated that he believed the price of Muramasa blades would increase after the collapse of the Tokugawa shogunate. The fact that the shogunate strongly despised these swords was the reason that Shigeyoshi was ordered to commit seppuku. In the days leading up to his death, Shigeyoshi handed out his swords one by one to his loyal retainers until there was only one left, the sword Skyroot, which had been commissioned by the demon swordsman Udo. Finally, he gave Skyroot to his most loyal retainer. However, after Shigeyoshi's death, the retainer is said to have traded the sword to a Dutch sea captain for a pair of matchlock pistols. Thus, it is said Shigeyoshi's spirit is doomed to walk the land forever, searching for his lost Muramasa. Your killer may be the reincarnated spirit of Shigeyoshi. Let me see that. Sarah got off the sofa and knelt next to Copkind, who sat cross-legged on a cushion in front of the coffee table. The old book had been entirely handwritten in elegant penmanship that reminded Sarah of the style booklets she studied as a grade school student. It must have taken forever, a true labor of love. Her fingers traced the ancient script, the sword polisher breathing over her shoulder. It was her dream. She dreamed she was Shigeyoshi. Had she heard the story before, or had the spirit sought her out because of the witchblade? But in her dream, Shigeyoshi did not succumb to the shogun's order. He had struck back, slaying his appointed executioner. She was aware of David's fragrance, masculine with a touch of lime, followed by the touch of his hand on her arm. She turned toward him, lips parted, and they came together like magnetic dogs, falling backwards onto the cushions. First he kissed her tentatively, but she reached up behind his head and pulled him close. Heat blossomed. Copkind's ridiculously smooth fingers roamed her body, her hands cradling his head. His groin banged into hers like the crusaders at the gates of Damascus. They sprawled. "You want to unfold that futon?" she said huskily. "Okay," he replied in a choked voice. He climbed unsteadily to his feet, leaving Sarah tumbled amid cushions, practically threw the futon open, went around the room turning off lights until the only illumination was the soft glow from the kitchen. Smiling, Sarah stood and peeled off her shirt. David was mesmerized, a deer caught in headlights. She grappled with his belt. "Come on, you. Don't go wobbly on me now." Copkind's body was lean and hard, as she'd suspected, but his style was soft and gentle. Just before they joined, he turned her face to his. "Should I wear a rubber? Do you have protection?" A silver laugh bubbled from her lips. Not a day of illness since she got it. The witchblade would never tolerate a baby, another life form horning in on its private preserve. "It's okay," she whispered. "Are you clean?" "I'm so clean I scrubbed away my fingerprints." 15 minutes later they lay in each other's arms, pleased and astonished. "I can't believe I just did the wild thing with a cop." Sarah snuggled against him. "Very well, I might add. It's best to have sex on an empty stomach, don't you think? That way, you don't have to spend the whole evening worrying about whether you're going to get laid. We can enjoy our dinner." "Oh, Sarah?" David swooped and kissed her hard. "They're going to have to create a new category for you. A 12. No, there is no category. You are the greatest woman who ever lived." "Not hardly, but it's nice of you to say so." David sat, reached for his skivvies. "Would you settle for greatest woman I've ever met?" She watched him with big eyes, knees drawn up to her chin. "Yeah, I would. So where are we going for dinner?" "City club, around the corner. Sort of a Spanish/French sort of place. Plus the music. This guy Ray Rideout is straight out of Bird by way of Phil Woods." "Who?" "He's a terrific sax player. You'll like him." It was 7 by the time they descended the Mayan steps to the subterranean city club. Many restaurants had occupied the space at 223 East Houston Street. The basement reminded Sarah of old Italian restaurants, with its exposed brick Roman arches dividing the rooms, white linen tablecloths, and paintings of the Pyrenees. They must have had that lover's glow, because the waiters treated them like royalty, hovering, solicitous, eager to please. It was a magical evening. David blushed charmingly when the waiter handed him the wine list, was grateful when Sarah held out her hand. "Let me see. All children of Italian Americans know something of the grape." After determining they were going to order fish and poultry, Sarah ordered a California Chardonnay. "You can order the French stuff. I'm not exactly poor." She balanced her chin on her bridged fingers and batted her lashes. "I refuse to patronize the French for a laundry list of grievances about which I shall not bore you at this time." "Perhaps later?" he asked hopefully. "Perhaps." The band, sax, drums, piano, and bass, filed in and began to play Fool on the Hill. They ate slowly, lingered through the long set, returned to David's just before midnight, and made love again on the futon while Yoshi snarled and yawned around the base of the bed. Sarah lay in David's sleeping arms, wide awake. She was pleasantly exhausted, but her mind would not shut down. Vroom, vroom it went. Was this the man who would make an honest woman of her? Would Vince have liked him? And how? What about the witchblade? Would the witchblade permit her to let someone into her life? "Dear witchblade, there's, someone I'd like you to meet." Did Sarah believe in reincarnation? Since acquiring the witchblade, there were few things in which she didn't believe. If Gaia, Athena, Hildegard, Shiva, Kali, or Brunhild, whatever the name of the ancient deity that inhabited the Witchblade, could live again through her, then Shigeyoshi could live again to claim his precious sword. Skyroot. The root of all evil. It was, after all, priceless, the desire of powerful men. Would the killings stop when the killer finally possessed the sword? Would the sword ever surface? What criteria would a ghost samurai use for choosing a host? Certainly, Shigeyoshi would want someone physically capable. Sharp was capable. He also had the knowledge. And the swords. The swords? She'd completely forgotten the detailed drawings she'd made of the swords she discovered in Staten Island. David stirred, one hand falling to her hip. What? I don't know. All of a sudden I felt you get all tense and it woke me up. I'm sorry. Go back to sleep. David stretched languorously. What time is it? Sarah glanced at the bedside digital. 5 o'clock. David sat up, swung his legs to the floor. Time to feed the livestock. Sarah watched him head for the bathroom, admiring his muscular backside and, oh yeah, his butt. He was in and out of the shower in just 5 minutes. Yup, guys definitely had it easier. He was dressed in jeans and a white tank as he started rattling things in the kitchen. Sarah emerged from the bathroom a half hour later. She'd pinned her hair up for a neck-down shower, and dressed in her sensible Gap khakis and a stretchy knit beige top. Fetching her notes from the previous night, she joined David in the kitchen where he was whipping up scrambled eggs and cheese. He removed a bottle of grapefruit juice from the refrigerator. My old polishing instructor, Kenji, told me to always drink grapefruit juice with eggs. It breaks down the cholesterol. I didn't know they had grapefruit in Japan. David laughed. Kenji got that out of Parade magazine. David, I wonder if you could look at some drawings I made of some swords and help me identify them. I can try. She laid out her notes and drawings. David pondered them in silence. I see you have a long slender blade here with deep koshisori and a kokisaki, or small point. This is a Kamakura period tachi from maybe the 1300s, but I can't tell the smith from this. You've done a remarkable job. This one has what looks like a crab claw choji pattern to the temper line. That is a trademark of the Sukesada smiths from Bizen province, but it could be anything from late Koto to mid Edo period. I'd have to see the signature, or look at the blade in person to be sure. Where did you get this? I can't say. David went through the drawings. I don't recognize any of these swords. Did you do these drawings? These are good. Can you tell for sure if any of them are Muramasa's? No, I can't. But I can say, there's such diversity of styles, they represent the work of several different swordsmiths and time periods. Not much help, huh? Nope. She kissed him on the cheek. I like you anyway. I have to go to work. Unlock your garage for me. When can I see you again? Is tonight too soon? Yes? Sarah laughed. I'm busy tonight. However, Saturday I have to go to the mayor's house for a cocktail party. As in Gracie Mansion? As in the mayor of New York? Yes, and don't get excited. It's politics. Would you like to be my date? Sarah had repacked everything in her overnight bag and the detachable tank bag. David helped her carry them to the workshop, where she reattached everything to the bike, put on her jacket and helmet, straddled the bike and walked it out the door. David tried to kiss her through the helmet, but her lips remained tantalizingly beyond reach. Story of my life, she said, thumbing the starter. The Yamaha thrummed to life. David held the gate for her as she let out the clutch and slid into the alley. A United Waste Management truck completely occluded the alley, like a rhinoceros in a chute, snorting, stinking, bellowing to frighten lesser creatures. With a sigh, Sarah turned and headed the wrong way down the one-way alley until she exited on 2nd Avenue, turned, and headed uptown.